This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
This is Trey. Thank you for joining us for the Tuesday edition of our podcast. And this is a real treat for me. If you listen to this podcast, if you watch the television show, if you have read really any of the three books I've written, then I have cited, quoted, paraphrased, stolen from today's guest. I try not to steal. I try to give him credit. I quoted a story that he included in one of his books in my last book, because that story had a profound impact on me. There are two books sitting on my bedside table right now as we speak, and that's been true for over a decade. There's the Bible, which makes my mom and my wife very happy. And then there's a book called Gates of Fire, which is my favorite book of all time, written by an author who is currently living. I love Dostoevsky and I love Tolstoy, but Gates of Fire struck me in a way that no other book has. He's written scores of other books, historical fiction, fiction, nonfiction. His name is Stephen Pressfield, and we are delighted to have you with us today. Welcome to you.
Hey, thanks, Trey. It's a pleasure to be here. We've been trying to do this for a while, and I'm glad we finally got it together.
Well, I am semi-retired, maybe on the way to being fully retired. Depends on, you know, the ratings for my TV show, but you're a busy guy. So thank you for doing this.
All right. My pleasure.
I want to talk to you about your craft, your artistry, but also how people listening can maybe practice their own artistry. Is it true that for nearly two decades, you worked your artistry, your craft, without getting a single penny in return?
That's true. I think it was a little more than that, in fact. Yeah.
Was it a love of what you were doing? Was it a self-belief that eventually this is going to catch? What caused you to keep going?
It was one of those things. And, you know, I think when you ask a question, ask an artist or somebody, why do you do what you do? I mean, the real answer is because you can't do anything else. And I don't mean that you can't get hired to do anything else, but just your heart can't stand it to do that, you know? So in many ways for me, the lack of success over such a long time was a good thing, because it forced me to ask the question and answer it, why am I doing this? You know, because my family would ask that question, you know, what's wrong with this guy? You know, why does he keep doing this? And it certainly wasn't for money. It certainly wasn't for recognition, because I wasn't getting any of that. And so it just kind of came down to me for the love of the game. You know, if you're a musician, you just love to play music. You know, if you're an artist, you feel like you have to do something visually. And for me as a writer, I felt like, you know, I just had to keep going until something broke through.
I like to kind of tell people what you're good at may be different from what you love. And you got to find a way to marry up what you're good at with what you love. That's the advice I give, free advice I give teenagers. You clearly loved it. But were there moments when you like doubted, well, am I good enough to be published? Because I think it was decades before your first novel was published, wasn't it?
Yeah, I was 52 years old. And yeah, I mean, I totally, self-doubt was like, I woke up with it every morning and live with it every day. I just thought to myself, you know, just what you say, Trey, are you good enough for this? Are you ever going to be good enough for this? And for all that length of time, I really wasn't. You know, I look back at the stuff that I wrote then and it just wasn't good enough. But the great thing about writing, as opposed to, say, playing in the NBA, is you can get better at it, you know? If just through hard work and trying, you can get better over time. You can learn.
I guess the legend of Bagger Vance is when you, if the right phrase, and if you take offense at this phrase, then stop me, you burst onto the scene. Is that fair to say with
That's
the legend of Bagger Vance?
A little bigger than what actually happened, but it certainly was the first actual validation, you know, a published novel, that kind of thing. So, yeah, that was a big moment for me. That definitely was the moment when I felt I turned a corner.
All right. So I am a rabid golfer. My wife would tell you that is what I do for a living, is play golf.
I thought you were a golfer, Trey. I forgot about that. Yeah.
So you have written, and I want people to think about this for a second. You have written about golf, which is a pretty complex topic, skill-wise and psychologically. The book I made reference to is The Battle at Thermopylae. You've written about Alexander the Great. You've written about the Amazons. You've written about World War II. Those are all individually things that people might specialize in. How do you research something and are comfortable enough to write about it? There are people who specialize in each one of those individually. So how do you do that?
Sometimes people will mistake me for a classical scholar, because I've written, you know, a bunch of stuff set in the ancient world. But the truth is, I really only sort of drill down in a very narrow silo, you know, of what exactly I'm working on. Like Gates of Fire is about the ancient Spartans and the Battle of Thermopylae. So I just kind of read everything I could on that subject, which is not that much. And if you were to ask me a question that was adjacent to that, you know, about Thebes or something like that, I would be totally clueless. So I just sort of bore down in that one little silo where like I was talking to somebody the other day. I used to do my research at the UCLA library before digital stuff became a thing. And they have a shelf there of Alexander the Great books that's maybe 3 feet long, you know, just books about him. And so I just read all of them. But that's not that hard to do, you know. It'd be like a college thing or something like that. Yeah.
I mean, I'm going to let people judge it for themselves. I mean, they go read Gates of Fire. And because when I read that, I then did what you just said. You did. I said, okay, this is one of the most fascinating cultures with all of its flaws and positive attributes. It's a fascinating culture. So I said, what all is out there that I can go read? I found maybe 3 books, maybe 2 professors.
Yeah, yeah.
But your book is every bit as detailed as what they wrote. Think about the way Spartans waged battle and the detail that you put in there. You tell a story about dropping your sword versus dropping your shield, which I have stolen and used before. Mm. Did that come out of a research? Did you discover
that? That's from Plutarch, that thing about, for our listeners, I'll give you the little slightly longer version of that. It's like the question that was asked by Plutarch, I think, was, why do the Spartans punish with a fine a warrior who loses his helmet or his breastplate, but punish with the loss of all citizen rights the warrior who loses his shield? And the answer was that helmet and breastplate are worn for the protection of the individual warrior, but the shield is for the protection of the whole line, because the shield sort of overlapped and partly covered the man next to you. So I just thought, yeah, I've just found that in the research, reading Plutarch, and I just thought it was absolutely great, you know, really, just really expressed their ethic, you know, to the infinite degree.
I actually used that in a nominating speech for 2 guys that wound up later becoming the Speaker of the House. So for better or worse, that may not have been what you intended when you wrote it.
Uh-oh.
You may say, I wish you'd never read that. But it was, I don't know, there's a reason that book's on my bedside table. I think it is an amazing book, but so too, I mean, the book on the Amazon. So how do you go from Spartan culture and understanding really the role of women in Spartan culture was a big part of that? Alexander the Great to the Amazons. How does the mind go from one to the other?
Well, you know, we're all interested in different things, right, Trey? I mean, you can go from golf to politics to you know, any number of other things, but I'm always looking for something that grabs me, you know, some sort of something that I can really, because a novel is going to take 2.5-3 years, you know, so you got to fall in love with something. And for me, for that story about, you know, the Amazons were this supposedly legendary race of all female warriors. And I always thought, oh, that's, could that possibly be true? You know, I mean, it's such a great legend that you think, no, it can't be true. But there's another passage in Plutarch where which I quote at the start of the book, where he talks about Plutarch lived in Athens in the first century A.D. And the Amazons, supposedly an army of women, supposedly invaded Athens around 1200 A.D. So 1200 years earlier than B.C., I'm sorry. So he, Plutarch, writing about this, he talks about that there are still, at that time, graves of the Amazons. There are names of places that were there that could only have come from that. There was a whole part of the city called Amazonium. So when I kind of read that, I thought, wow, this could actually be true. And that sort of got me going. I just thought, okay, I got to explore this and see what this is all about. It's just too great a subject, you know, because I'm kind of a believer that women, as we know them today in the Western patriarchal or Eastern patriarchal culture, seem to me to be not who they fully are, not fully realized, you know. And I thought that was what appealed to me about the Amazons. I mean, the concept of the Amazons was that they were a horse culture, like the American, you know, like the Sioux, Lakota Sioux, or the Cheyenne or Comanche or something, and that the horse was sort of made them the equal of any kind of warrior. On horseback, they were also supposedly the first to use iron weapons as opposed to bronze weapons, and the first to actually fight as organized cavalry rather than just crazy people on horseback. So I thought that makes them physically the equal of men in combat, right? And so then it was just fascinating to me of what would a society like that be like? What would women be like in a culture like that, where they don't have to marry and depend upon a man or whatever, you know? So anyway, that's kind of, you know, I just got fascinated by that subject and then plunged into it for a few years.
This is going to sound like a business question, but it's not a business question. It is a practicality question that I bet our listeners are sitting there thinking, okay, you read something by Plutarch that just totally captured your imagination. How do you go from that to convincing your publisher, your agent, whoever needs to be convinced that, hey, this idea is worth me investing the next 18 to 36 months on?
That's a great question, Trey. It's like, I think, again, because I've failed for so long and I would write, you know, for two years or 2.5 years and nothing would come of it, I sort of had the mindset that I'm willing to do this totally on the come, totally on spec, any project that I would pick up. I wouldn't need a contract. And even for fiction, as you know, you can't get a contract, right? A publisher obviously wants to see the whole book because they want to know if it works, right? Not for nonfiction, but for fiction. So I just sort of figure I have to ask myself, if I put in 2 or 2.5 years on this and nothing comes of it, is that okay with me? And in this case, I said to myself, yeah, it is okay with me. It's, you know, it just sort of, I just sort of came up, you know, believing in betting on yourself.
I'm only smiling because of how accurate what you just said was. I am moving from what they think, I guess they call self-help. It's really, I'm moving from how to teach people to ask questions or make decisions to my first foray into fiction, which is a crime novel. And you are very right. There's a big appetite for losing weight. There is less of an appetite for a book about some imaginary crime drama. But you raise a fascinating...
Let me interrupt you just for a second, yes. Trey, to say, let me congratulate you for that, you know. Let me give you props. I salute you. God bless you. It takes balls to do that, you know. And it's great that you're doing that, that you're pushing yourself into an area that might be out of your comfort zone. I wish you the best of luck.
It is sheer love. And what you said resonates with me. I will do it if no one else has any interest in reading it, because I've always wanted, I was a prosecutor for almost 2 decades, and I'm fascinated by crime and what it does to people and why they commit it. So, all right, I was on your website. And it seems like Gates of Fire and other books are listed under fiction. I consider them historical fiction. That's how I describe them when I'm telling people you need to read. To me, that seems the hardest of all, because some professor at Oxford or Cambridge is going to say, well, he got this wrong. That's not the way their military moved. So you're going to get fact checked on half of it. And then the other half will be critiqued from, creativities. That seems to me to be the hardest genre. But you've spent a lot of time in that genre. So what do you think?
I mean, again, it's just what you love. You know, it's like what you were just talking about prosecution and the crime and something like that. I just am fascinated by other eras, particularly the ancient world. You know, maybe previous lives. Maybe I was alive at that time in some way. I don't know. But on the other hand, it is kind of easier in a way, Trey, because at least you're starting with something that actually happened. That's like true. If I'm writing, I wrote two books about Alexander the Great. And at least, you know, you can read up and see this happened, that happened. He said this, that. And then you just sort of insert your own imagination. Imagine yourself back into that space and then sort of ask yourself, well, what would really happen if we were really there?
We'll be right back with more of the Trey Gowdy Podcast.
I'm Charles Payne. Listen to my Unstoppable Prosperity Podcast so I can get you making money right now. Whether stocks are hitting new all-time highs or in freefall mode, opportunities abound. So why are so many potential investors still sitting on the sidelines? In a new season of my podcast, I'm going to get you in the game. After 38 years on Wall Street, I'm ready to impart some lessons and get you invested in the greatest wealth-generating machine in history. Listen anytime, everywhere at foxbusinesspodcast.com or wherever you listen to your favorite podcast.
When you wrote your book on Afghanistan, I mean, did you have any idea that it would still play such a prominent role on the world stage? I mean, you've got Russia and I mean, Alexander the Great and the United States and I guess other countries that have gotten involved in Afghanistan.
Well, the book that you're talking about is the Afghan campaign, and it's about Alexander the Great's campaign in Afghanistan in 333 to 330 BC. And when I started to write that, we were already over there fighting, you know. Okay. So when I was studying Alexander and I came to that part of his life, I thought, this is exactly like what's going on there now. You know, it's another Western army, you know, what for the time was highly technically advanced, unbeaten. And they were getting their butt kicked by these primitive tribesmen. And so I just thought, this is a book all by itself. It was a chapter in a previous book. But then I thought, let me write an entire book on this because it's so interesting.
When I'm trying to encourage people to go read that book, I tell them Alexander the Great basically changed who he was and became the enemy he was fighting long enough to fight to a draw. And then he got out. That's how I summarize the book. But it seemed to me like he became maybe what he really was, but it changed him. Fighting and losing in that way changed him. But you wrote the book. What was your take on it?
I would agree with that completely. And it's sort of happening to every other army that goes in there, too, with maybe the exception of the British, who just refused to change and just got massacred over and over again. But, you know, he was a Western, general, commander, conqueror that in his previous wars had fought kings, Darius of Persia and so on and so forth, that if you beat them on the field, they would surrender. You could then march into, Babylon and the city would turn out and throw rose petals in front of you. But in Afghanistan, no matter how many times you won, the enemy was never going to give you an inch, So Alexander had to sort of sink to their level, I don't want to put it that way because it really wasn't their level, And he, began massacres and, transshipments of entire population. And so I go along with what you say, Trey. That's my way I look at it, too. And then he just sort of declared victory, married a princess and got the hell out of there.
Got out of there. I think it's either that book or the bigger book you wrote on Alexander the Great that I want to come back and ask you about something you included that I borrowed, gave you credit for, and put in my last book. But you, at some point, it looks like your interest went from historical fiction to nonfiction to, I'm not going to call it self-help. I mean that as a compliment, but other people may not take it that way. But you pivoted. It was a different genre of book. Is that a different phase of life? Did you say, look, I've done everything I want to do on the other side? What caused that?
Well, are you talking about the War of Art, Trey?
The War of Art would be the first one, yes, sir.
That was really just sort of a one-off for me. You know, I was writing the historical fiction, and I wrote the War of Art, and then I went right back to historical fiction for a few more books. And then I kind of went back and kind of followed up on the War of Art after that. So I'm still sort of bouncing back and forth. The one I'm working on a book right now that's also set in the ancient world. So, but as far as the War of Art went, it's really about the creative process, as you know, and the sort of the devils that live in our head, you know, that war that we have to fight against our own self-sabotage and tendency to procrastinate and all that kind of stuff. And I just had talked to various friends. Friends would come to me and say, I got a book in me, you know, will you help me? You know, and I would sit up with them at night, you know, till 2 a.m. and try to warn them about the devil in their own head that they were going to have to fight against. And of course, nobody paid any attention to me. Nobody ever wrote the books that they want. But I thought, let me just put this down on paper. And then if anybody asks me about it again, I'll just say, here, read this. So so that was how the War of Art I wrote in like 2 months. But I mean, as you know, it's a short book with really short chapters.
Yes. Well, I guess you lived it. I mean, you lived through it. That helped you write it so quickly. It wasn't like you had to go research it.
No, it was totally, you know, burned into my brain for 30 years. So I just had to just find a way to find the idiom and then put it on paper.
All right. I want to pick up on a couple of things that you reference in that, or at least what I took from it. And you tell me I misread it, or maybe it's close and this is how it can help people. The enemy within, that I have seen the enemy and it is I, that we defeat ourselves far more often than outside forces defeat us.
That's it. You got, that's the whole premise, the thesis of the book. And it's absolutely true. And I've heard it from so many people who've written me letters and emails and stuff like this. It's like when you sit down at a typewriter or a blank page or a piano or anything like that, I think we all can agree that there's a negative force that sort of radiates off of that thing. Like when you're writing, I'm sure you, I want to ask you, when you sit down and are working on your crime story, and that force kind of tries to distract you, tries to get you to put it off till tomorrow, tries to tell you you're not good enough. Who do you think you are trying this stuff, right? You're too old, you're too young, you're too fat, you're too thin, blah, blah, blah. And that force, that voice in our head is universal. And you're right. It's what defeats people. I would say anybody that wants to have any kind of creative career, even if it's only just one thing, one book, one movie, one record album or whatever, the first thing you have to do before you even start to think about craft is master that demon in your mind, that dragon that has to be slain anew every morning. And I can tell you from doing this for 50 years, it never goes away and it never gets any easier.
The dragon that I see most often is this belief that there is nothing new under the sun, that it all goes back. It's all either a footnote to Plato or Jesus. I mean, nothing is new. So who am I to think that I'm going to come up with something that is novel? That is the dragon that I hear. I wonder, are there dragons you still hear? You said maybe there were, and what those dragons are.
That is one dragon, Trey, that I would say if we had a bouquet of dragons in front of us and we had 100 people who tried to write or paint or whatever, some would pick that little rose and others would pick others. The force of that I call resistance with a capital R is trying to stop us. So it's a voice in our head that's trying to stop us from doing our work. So it will pick because it is intelligent, ever-changing, ever-shifting, diabolically clever. It will pick the one thought that hits us closest to home. That's it for you, you know, the idea that it's been done before. But the one for me is about the subject matter itself. I'll have a voice in my head that'll say, who's going to care about this subject that you think is so great? The Battle of Thermopylae. Nobody can spell it. Nobody can pronounce it. Nobody knows where it is. Why is anybody? And the bottom line is all of these voices are all full of shit, if you'll forgive me on your show here. They're all bogus, and we all have to look past them and just sit down and do the work.
Yeah, it's fascinating you say that. I mean, I guess I'm the only one who've never heard of the Battle of Thermopylae or Hot Gates until until I read your book. And then there was a movie that came out either right before or right after called 300.
Yeah.
And some people confuse the two. And I would always say, no, you got to go read the book.
Yeah. Here's a little quick backstory on that, if you don't know that, Trey. In Hollywood, they have this term called development. Do you know what? Does that ring a bell at all?
A little bit. Yes, sir.
It's like a script or a movie idea is, quote unquote, in development when it's moving from a raw idea or a rough script until it's ready for production, until it's a finished script. It's been cast. It has a budget, that sort of thing. And at this one particular time, Gates of Fire was in development in Hollywood. And at the same time, there was this graphic novel by Frank Miller called 300. And they were going like two trains going down parallel tracks. And 300 won. And as soon as it won, it got put together as a movie that killed Gates of Fire. So 300 has nothing to do with Gates of Fire.
Yeah. I now that I think about it, that makes perfect sense, because I'm sitting there wondering why that book was nothing against Legend of Bagger Vance. I love golf. Matt Damon, I'm sure, is a great guy. But I'm sitting there thinking, why was Gates of Fire not made into a movie? And it's because Frank Miller's thing was sitting over there, I guess, in development, maybe at the same time. But
yeah, that was it.
No offense. I mean, I saw the movie, too. I don't know. The stories that you told in Gates of Fire, I don't know. It'd be more than a movie. It'd be a miniseries. So, all right. Self-doubt, to me, is a little bit different from self-sabotage. When you talk about the resistance within, are you including all of that, or do you have like a all separate of way of battling self-sabotage as opposed to self-doubt?
I would say self-sabotage is sort of the overwhelming, the big category, the overarching category. And under it, one of the ways that we sabotage ourselves is with self-doubt. And other ways are distraction or the kind of the rationale that you had. Oh, it's all been done before. Why should I waste my time doing it? That kind of thing. But self-sabotage is the overall arching thing, because there also is such a thing, if you're a writer or an artist of any kind, as sabotaged by other people, people close to you who will, kind of condescend to you. Oh, Trey, you're writing a crime novel. Hey, good for you. Good luck. I'm sure it's going to be great. We're all waiting for it. That kind of thing, But then self-sabotage doesn't need other people. We just do it to ourselves.
Well, you've had about every job you can possibly have, including, I believe, if I read this correctly, you worked in a psychiatric wing of a hospital or something close there, too.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering why we biologically, evolutionarily, why we have that in us that wants to defeat us.
I have my explanation, but it's kind of getting into the weeds a little bit.
That's okay. I mean, I think everybody listening deals with self-doubt and self-sabotage. And, a lot of people that listen to this have kind of a spiritual, religious underpinning. And so, I don't think blame God's not the right way of putting it, but they're going to. I just wonder, I mean, we're biologically wired to run in the face of danger, to defend ourselves. The adrenaline kicks in, but yet we're biologically wired to doubt ourselves.
Okay, I'll give you my theory here, Trey, for whatever it's worth. If you think of the structure of the human psyche, I would say there's at least two big parts to it. One is the ego, which we would define as how we, when we refer to ourselves as I, it's rational, it's reality-based, it's materialistic. the ego is acquisitive, the ego is aggressive, the ego is competitive, the ego is fearful, the ego is kind of the small part of our mind. And then there's a bigger part that I would call the self, with a capital S, stealing from Jung and from, you know, the world of psychology. And to me, how I would define the self, it's a much bigger thing than the ego. The ego is contained within it. The self would contain the collective unconscious, intuition, dreams come from the self. All of those things that you can't kind of explain come from the self. And in fact, in the model that I see, the self abuts against what they call the divine ground. In other words, God, right? Something that we can't explain. So when we as artists or any kind of creative people are trying to tap into that field of possibility that will produce a symphony or a novel or whatever it is, we're trying to get to the self, the capital S self. And if we can make a shift to that place, then we can tap into intuition. We can tap into a flow state. It's a little bit like golf. It's a lot like golf, right? And so I think that what happens when we start to make the first tentative moves into the self, like a musician that sits down at the piano and just kind of starts to trust themselves and do kind of crazy stuff that comes out good. When that starts to happen, the ego revolts against it, because the ego can feel it's about to be put out of a job. It's like, if this guy or this gal can tap into that greater power, what do they need me for? And so I think it's the ego protecting itself that throws up this negative stuff and tries to stop you, tries to sabotage you, you know, and puts that voice in your head that says, you can't do this. And of course, if we believe that voice, the ego wins and we don't shift to the self.
I don't know if it was Jung or Freud that came up with that first, but it has been around so long that it's beginning to make me think it's real. What you just said is real. I've seen it so many times. I'm not talking about writing books. I'm not talking about writing. I'm talking about just that self-doubt. Your explanation is as good as any other one I've heard. I mean, I don't know why we would be wired to like protect ourselves. I used to see these self-defense wounds. They're automatic that we defend ourselves. Mm. And yet what you and I are talking about is like automatic stabbing ourselves. If you're enjoying our conversation, you can find more just like this at foxnewspodcast.com. All right, well, I want to end on something happier. I need to have you on every week, because you sent the nicest gift package of anyone I've ever. I mean, most of my friends I have on, they send me a bill. They don't send me like a gift package.
Well, I'll send you a bill too if you want one.
Send me a bill. I'm broke, but send it. I want to read something to you, and you tell me if you recognize it, okay?
Okay.
Keep watching movies and TV. Keep studying stuff that works. Study how Hemingway did it, or Tolstoy, or Toni Morrison. That counts as work. You go on. This is day 350 in what is called the Daily Press Field, which is, I don't want to say it's a devotional, but it's a daily list of things that are worth thinking about. How did that idea pop into your head?
Do you know who Ryan Holiday is?
How do I know?
One of the books he's written is called The Daily Stoic. He's a big kind of champion of stoicism.
A Marcus Aurelius kind of stuff?
Yeah, exactly.
Yes, okay. Yeah, okay.
And so he has a book called The Daily Stoic. And we're friends. And he said to me, he said, you should write something like this, a daily type of book, because you've got so much content. You got so much stuff from all your years of, you know, struggle. You should put it together, because it could really help people, you know, so that they could start on day one of a year if they're working on some kind of long-term project like you working on your crime book, and that this book could sort of help them as they go through, you know, defeat their own self-sabotage, encourage them, inspire them, motivate them, that kind of thing. And it would be where I could draw from all of my stuff, not just the self-helpy books, but historical fiction and nonfiction and so on and so forth. So I just thought this would be something that could really help people. So I gave it a shot. It's
It does. And
it's out right now. If I may give it a plug, it's coming out right now for Christmas.
Oh, no, I'm sitting here looking at it. And look, I want people to go read everything you have ever written. But if they say, look, Gates of Fire seems a little long for me to start with and start with the Daily Press Field, I do want to ask you about a small little section that you put in. I don't think it was the Afghan campaign. I think it was the bigger book about Alexander the Great. But I want to ask you about it because that's actually part of the reason I left politics was really? Was reading that section of it, which
wow,
a lot of people
will
be
story.
A lot of people will be very, very happy with you because that led me to get out of politics. You'll be very popular.
Well, that was my intention all along.
Well, it worked. It worked. But before I ask you that, I do want to ask you. They tell me that you know mediocre writers can write about what they know. The really, really great writers like you can write about stuff that they haven't experienced. That you know, those of us that are not all that good at it, we write about what we know. Having said that, is there a character that you especially fell in love with, respected, wished that you had known more about, wished had been real in any of the books that you've written? Is there one character that stands out in your mind the most? Is that is somebody I really wish I'd gotten to know?
Well, that's a great question. There's a bunch of them. Of course, like your characters are like your children, right? You know, you always want. But there's a true historical character in my third book called Tides of War, and the character is Alcibiades. I'm sure that from Athens, who was this guy who, as a general, was never defeated, but who was sentenced to death by his own people, defected to Sparta, was sentenced to death by them, defected to Persia, then defected to the Thracians, and just led a crazy life all the way through. And I would love if I could be beamed back and just to see, could this guy be real? He's like such a larger than life, amazing character. He's the guy I would love to see who he really was and what it was really all about.
I may have him confused with someone else you wrote about. That book is phenomenal, by the way. Was he also not like generally considered to be the most handsome person on earth?
Yeah, that's what they said, that like it was said of him that at every stage of life, as a boy, as a youth, as a young man, as a man of mature years, he was like the best looking person anybody had ever seen. And one other tiny tidbit of him about him, he entered in the Olympic Games back in the day, that he won first, second, and third in the chariot race as an individual, not as a country. So this is the kind of a guy he was. But tell me your story, Trey, about getting out of politics. I got to hear
this.
Well,
I want you to tell the story because you wrote it, but I will tell you what it is. Alexander the Great is about to cross a footbridge, either going into India or he's in India. And an Indian wise man is coming on the other side of the footbridge. Do you remember it now?
Yeah, it's a little bit different than that, but I know what you're talking about. Yeah.
All right. Well, then, like I said, I paraphrased and corrupted some of your great stories.
I kind of like the footbridge. It's good.
You use another word, not Indian wise man. So, is S-A-H-U, or I'll misspell
sadhu,
it.
Sadhu, S-A-D-H-U,
okay.
Meaning, you know, kind of a yogi. A holy man that lives without, you know, just with a begging bowl and a diaper.
Right. And what I remember is Alexander the Great's men said, make way. The greatest man on earth is coming. He's conquered the world. At least that's what I remember. So if I'm really, really wrong, don't tell me, because the story's meant a lot to me. And then this Indian wise man responds that I'm the most powerful man in the world because I have conquered the need to conquer the world.
That's pretty much the story. And it supposedly is a true anecdote. I didn't make it up. Like, so a young lieutenant, actually, Alexander was walking along a footpath, sort of, and there were a bunch of yogis sitting in the sun, you know, and their legs, you know, in the lotus position. And the young officers cleared them all out because Alexander was coming, except for this one guy. So the young lieutenant said to the yogi, pointing to Alexander, he said, this man has conquered the world. What have you done? And the yogi said, I have conquered the need to conquer the world. And Alexander the Great supposedly laughed, burst out laughing in a positive way. He thought that was a great thing that the guy said. And he said to his retinue, he said, if I could be anyone in the world other than myself, I would be this man here. Which I thought was great. So tell me your story about politics.
Well, I mean, you will not remember this, but someone on my staff knew that I love Gates of Fire, one of the folks that worked for me when I was in Congress. And he somehow, I don't know how he found you, but he got me a signed copy of Gates of Fire. That's the one that sits on my bedside table. Ah. You signed it. And so I love to read. I rarely reread books, but I have reread Gates of Fire more than I have reread all other books put together. Because you miss stuff, I mean, or you don't remember stuff. I just remember reading that and thinking, okay, he really is the most powerful man on earth because he defines what success is for him. It's not the accolades of taking over, conquering the world, of weeping for there were no more nations to conquer. He's sitting there with nothing, and yet he feels like he has conquered the world because he's conquered his own ambition and what other people thought about him. So once you understand that you get to define significance, other people don't do it for you. You define what a significant life is, then it liberates you to go do what you want to do. Mm. You don't care about what in Ridley Scott's, Gladiator, he screams at the crowd, are you not entertained? Mm-hmm. You don't have to worry about entertaining anyone else. Because you're at peace.
Ah.
When I looked at that and I thought, okay, I don't want to be here. So why am I here? I don't enjoy this. I don't want to be here. It's hard to leave what people perceive as a good job. It's hard to leave what people perceive as, fame's not the right word. Members of Congress aren't famous, but you're notorious. But if that's not how you define success, then you ought to leave. So that's what led me to do it. Well,
I take my hat off to you, Trey, because it seems like there's 488, however many people there are in Congress that can't push themselves to make that. I'm sure there are many, many people who think, what am I doing here? I'm not getting anything done. This is not what I really love to do. But somehow I guess it's so addictive, whatever, the power or whatever it is that you have, the feeling of significance or relevance, that it's really hard to let it go. So God bless you for, being able to walk away.
I play this game in my head that when I'm gone, what do I want people to say to my wife? I want them to say he was a good prosecutor, that he was funny and fair and a good prosecutor. I don't care about the rest of it. So if that's what I want to be said, then why don't I spend more time working on that? I don't care if they say he was in Congress. She may not remember. She doesn't follow politics. She may have forgotten. So if that's what you want to be known for, then, I guess you and I are close to the same age, but we're to the point where it's okay to be thinking about what people will remember.
Mm-hmm. Flashing back to what I said a few minutes ago about the ego and the self.
Yes, sir.
I would say that when you made that decision, Trey, you moved from the ego to the self. And you said, the ego is about being known and, getting accolades and that all that sort of stuff. But the self is really about, why am I here? What really matters to me? On my deathbed, what am I going to regret? And that's a great thing. That's a real evolution,
And for those who are interested in living beyond their time, writing books is a way to live beyond your time. I mean, it is something, I don't want to use the word legacy, but that is a legacy of sorts that outlives each of us.
Yeah, that's true, sort of, except these days, with attention spans being about 3.2 seconds and AI coming in. I don't know how much. I don't want to discourage you on your crime novel, but
I cannot be discouraged.
Enjoy the process.
Because I am going to enjoy the process. I'm going to test the limits of my creativity. I have been told by my agent that you may have to pay them to publish a fiction book. I mean, if you want to write a book about how to stop smoking, they'll pay you a lot of money. But if you want to write a book about crime fiction, probably not. But I've always wanted to do it, so why not do it?
Yeah, God bless you. How far along are you?
I have it in my head, and I'm and I probably have six chapters.
Uh-huh.
What I find is, because I don't have to fact check myself, although I did live some of these crimes as a prosecutor, you can like go down this rabbit hole where you're introducing a character, but you can kind of make up, give that whole character depth and breadth that doesn't have to be researched.
Yeah.
Make it up.
Yeah. Isn't that fun?
It is fun. Yeah. And it also, do you ever watch miniseries? Do you have a chance to watch stuff?
I do. Yeah. Yeah.
True Detective was a crime miniseries.
Yeah, with Matthew McConaughey and Woody Harrelson. Yeah.
That character that McConaughey played, Russ Cole, the cynicism. I mean, I don't mind people calling me a stoic. I think I probably am. But he had a level of cynicism that I'm fascinated by people who were kind of like that. I mean, that nothing matters, that everything is bad, that human nature is debased. So we're going to see where it goes. But I've had a publisher. Well, Penguin Random House has been great enough to publish my last two books. But I mean, look, there's so many people writing crime dramas. They're not going to take a chance on a washed up congressman. I wouldn't.
Well,
what's next for you?
True. I mean, you're a former prosecutor. You have a certain level of fame, you know. I mean, and all you got to do is write something good.
Well, and good.
What you said about that cynical attitude, I mean, that's right out of that genre, right? The Dashiell Hammett, this private eye, or the detective that's burned out and only sees the dark side. So that's, you can't get enough of that in that kind of story. It's always great.
Well, the more you're around crime, I mean, when it's all you see, you think it's all there is. And it gives you, if I worked around first grade school teachers and puppies, I would have a much better view of humankind. But you say you're working. I'm not prying. You say you're working on another piece from the classics. You've written about a lot of Greek characters. Any Roman characters in your future?
Yeah, this is actually, I wrote a book a couple of years ago called A Man at Arms, and it was about a guy who had lived a number of lives. He's actually in The Virtues of War, the Alexander the Great book, and so he sort of spans the Greek and Roman era, and this book that I'm working on now is kind of the further adventures of this particular character.
And it takes you... You said like 2 or 3 years?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Wow. Are you capable of working on more than one project at a time, or do you have
to? Yeah, I am. Yeah, definitely.
Okay. Well,
like right now, I'm kind of promoting the daily press field.
Yes.
Know? And so I'm sort of dividing my days between trying to get the word out on that and working on this ancient world book.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, I am looking at it. And like I said, you might not get the package that I got, but that's okay. As long as you just go get the book, I don't want to say devotional, but people that listen to my podcast know what I'm talking about. You're not reading Crime and Punishment every day. These are like a paragraph long, and they're not like dated. So you don't have to like pick it up on New Year's Day. You can if you want to, but there's a number. It's day 44 and it's day 1 and day 67. You can start it whenever you want to. What's going to happen, I'll tell you, ladies and gentlemen, what's going to happen is you're going to read a little vignette or story from a book and you're going to say, I'd like to go read the whole book. The books of his that I have read, I light up when I read a clause from it or a thought from it. So it's the daily press fill. Do what I've done. Read. I haven't read everything he's written, but everything he's written that I've read, I loved. So go pull up Stephen Pressfield, my favorite living author, and can't wait for what's coming next. And I can't thank you enough for joining us. I know you're a busy man, so thank you.
Hey, thanks for having me, Trey. And thanks for the very kind words. If I can say one thing about the Daily Pressfield, you can find it, go to my website, just my name, stephenpressfield.com, and it'll tell you how to get it and what the various options are. And someday you and I got to play golf. I mean, I'll come back to Spartanburg, you know.
I need some shots.
I need some shots.
I would love to play golf with you. It's a fascinating sport. It is really more like a cult than it is a sport, but I'd love to do it. My guess is that I'm going to need two shots a side. I think just being, looking at you, just being fair
I'm
about
need
it.
Two a hole from you.
All right, StephenPressfield.com. Are you on social media?
I'm on Instagram primarily, but also on Facebook. And I'm not a real Twitter person, or I guess Twitter isn't even Twitter anymore.
Yeah, I'm not.
I'm definitely on Instagram.
So people want to get the Daily Pressfield. They need to go to your website. They don't need to go on Amazon. They need to go to your website.
Okay. Thanks for asking that question, Trey. You can just get the book on Amazon, but we have on my website two special offers for like signed books. You know that you can get an actual just the book signed by me and the illustrator Vic Juhas, great illustrator. And then we also have that special gift package that you have.
Wow.
Too bad we don't have video here so we could show it. If you wanted to buy this book and give it to somebody that was, you know, working on a novel or a symphony or an album or something like that, this gift package is, you know, as you know, it's got a lot of extras in there, a little journal and blah, blah, blah. So that's all on just on my website. It's not available on Amazon, but the book itself is available there.
Well, I'm going to give some unsolicited advice to my friends that listen. Go to his website and get that gift package and then do what I did and open it and divide it up. And then you have all your Christmas gifts that you want to give to people. You can just get them out of that box and write somebody's name on it. Well, I wrote my wife's name on one of them. All your Christmas shopping is in that box. It is like everything else you have done. How in the world you made it to 50 or 51 or 52 without being recognized, I don't know. I'm glad you stuck with it. I'm glad that you fought the inner resistance and you stuck with it, because you are sure enough my favorite living author.
Well, thanks, Trey. And good luck with your crime novel.
Thank you.
I'm sure it's going to be great.
Thank you.
And let's stay in touch. We'll do this again.
I would love that. And you take care. All the best. And it is the Daily Pressfield. You can go to his website if you want everything. That's what you ought to do. If you just want it quick, Amazon, wherever books are sold. Thank y'all. And thank you, Mr. Stephen Pressfield. I'm so grateful to you.
Thank you, Trey.
Yes, sir. You take care.
See you next time.
Listen ad-free with a Fox News Podcast Plus subscription on Apple Podcasts. And Amazon Prime members can listen to this show ad-free on the Amazon Music app.
The Fox News Rundown, a contrast of perspectives you won't hear anywhere else. Your daily dose of news twice a day, featuring insight from top newsmakers, reporters, and Fox News contributors. Listen and subscribe now by going to foxnewspodcasts.com.